It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what do negotiations over border security funding, the State of the Union address, and 2020 presidential hopefuls all have in common? We're talking about all of these subjects as part of our weekly check-in on national politics. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, many schools, government offices, and businesses across Wisconsin remain closed due to the life-threatening cold. Even the Postal Service suspended regular mail delivery today. Multiple power outages have also been reported around the state. High temperatures were forecast to reach the negative teens before dropping to about 30 below tonight. Wind chills have exceeded 50 below. It's all because of a phenomenon known as the polar vortex. We'll talk about what that is and why some meteorologists are saying we may see more and more of those in winters to come. But first, we're going to talk with a couple of WPR reporters about how communities around the state are dealing with the deep freeze and how it's affecting various aspects of life. Corey Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, Corey, are you inside?
I am inside.
Okay, yeah. Good. Good. We'll get to the local stuff in a moment, but what has the state done to prepare for this cold?
Well, you know, I think that the different municipalities in the state saw this coming for several days beforehand, so they were preparing all along. I talked to different municipalities yesterday to find out what they were going to do for Wednesday, and they were already working with the Red Cross, different emergency services, and making sure that warming centers were open, that their various departments that didn't really need to be open today were going to be closed. So they were getting ready to make sure people that did not need to be outside were not going to be outside today.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett said at a news conference on Tuesday that after a mild start to January, he said, quote, the weather is up to its old tricks and decided it was going to let us have it right in the kisser now, end of quote. What's the city doing in response?
Well, the city really is shut down today. The only departments that are open are police and fire. The mayor had another press conference today where he reported that the police department has said that people are safe, that the people who live outside because of homelessness or other issues have been reported safe. There are 7 warming centers in the city with 300 beds. And the mayor also reported that he drove around and the streets really are clear. So the city is closed.
What's going on in local communities regarding the homeless?
Really, local communities seem to have all stepped up. They're opening up centers for the homeless. In Superior, they opened their first warming center, and that's happening statewide.
Schools are closed. Some districts have already canceled classes for tomorrow. What have you heard about the UW system?
The UW system is closed tomorrow until system-wide, I'm not exactly sure, but it appears that classes are closed until about noon tomorrow, is what I've been hearing from various schools. Milwaukee Public Schools is closed tomorrow again, which will be the 6th day that the state's largest public school district is closed.
Do you have any updates in regards to what else is happening around the state?
You know, just the state, the municipalities I've talked to are just telling people to do things that seem basic, but people might be forgetting about. Running their water to make sure pipes are still working and making sure that their water meters are kept warm enough. Just things like that. I mean, that's all people are doing is just trying to remember the basics.
Corey, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And stay warm.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. Now let's go to La Crosse and check in with reporter Hope Kerwin. She's going to talk about what we can do to keep warm, protect our pets, and make sure our homes are in good working order. Hope, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, I hope you're in a safe place and a warm place as well.
Yes, I'm holed up at home out of the cold.
Good for you. What's going on in southwestern Wisconsin?
Well, I know a lot of farmers and producers were preparing to protect their livestock this week as we see these terrible cold temperatures. Doing things like making sure they have shelter, dry bedding, places to get out of the wind and cold, and also making sure that they have unfrozen water. That's a really important part of helping animals to maintain their body heat if they don't have to work on, unfreezing that water, as long as they have access to unfrozen water.
And, speaking of livestock, how should we be taking care of our pets in this type of weather?
Well, pets are very similar to farm livestock as well. I mean, they need to be out of the elements, if that's at all possible, at least out of the wind. I know that if you're, taking your dog for a walk, people are suggesting keeping that to 10 minutes or less. Frostbite can set in as few as 5 minutes. So it's very important to not be outside for extended periods of time. And also, trying to put a coat or a sweater on your dog as well.
It's probably best to stay inside if we can, just switching over to humans. But if we have to go out, what's the best way to bundle up?
Well, the important parts are just to cover any exposed skin. So, everything from your hands to even your face. Like I said, frostbite can set in as few as 5 minutes, so just making sure that those areas are covered. And if you have to drive somewhere, making sure that you have adequate gas, making sure that you have blankets or hand warmers, an emergency kit in your car just in case. In case of an emergency, you don't want to be stranded. People are advising any travelers to let people know of their travel plans and when they plan to arrive at their destination to check in often because it's very dangerous to be stuck out in the cold.
Let's turn the focus to our homes for just a minute or so. Frozen pipes can be a big problem. How do we minimize the chance of that happening?
Well, people are suggesting just to keep your water running when you can. Occasionally turn on faucets. That freezing tends to happen when pipes are inactive, and so if you can just keep faucets running. Also, a good tip is to open the cabinets underneath the sink to make sure warm air is circulating under those pipes. Those are just some of the tips you can take advantage of.
So if we turn on the faucet, though, and no water comes out, what should we do?
Well, people are suggesting you know where your main water shutoff is on your house in case of that situation. You don't want to have a water pipe break. And I've also seen, people suggesting using things like hair dryers, even just to try to address frozen pipes and warm them up, get warm air circulating.
Now, energy use obviously goes up on days like this, but some people might be tempted to scale back to avoid a really big heating bill. What should people keep in mind about energy costs in weather like this?
Well, that is a huge concern, especially for people who are low income or income constrained. The tendency might be to turn down the thermostat if they're worried about paying a utility bill. But really, people who help low-income people really say don't worry about that a higher bill. There are assistance programs in every county in the state to help people pay their utility bill if they're having a hard time in the winter season. But it's really important to keep your thermostat turned up, keep the heat on, and to not use things like ovens or unventilated heaters, unsafe not for home heating sources. Those can be really unsafe sources of heat. When really you should just use your home's furnace or other heating system. Also, if people experience a heating system emergency, And, you know, the each county in the state also has crisis assistance for those sorts of situations. And so they can call their county and receive help in repairing or in some extreme cases, maybe even replacing a furnace that has gone out.
Hope, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And you stay warm.
You too.
Hope Kerwin is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in La Crosse. Coming up, we'll talk with a meteorologist about what's driving all this cold air to our neck of the woods. We also want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has the bitter cold affected you? Did you have to be outside for any extended period of time? Any problems with your car or pipes at home freezing or bursting? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner. We're continuing our discussion of the dangerously cold weather over Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest. Actual temperatures were only forecast to get up into the negative teens, with wind chills flirting with minus 50. The National Weather Service says temperatures may not rise above zero until Friday. Lots of businesses and government offices have closed. Lots of school districts have closed around the state. Even the Postal Service suspended delivery today. So we want to hear your stories about the cold. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. How have the cold temperatures affected you? Did you have to work or spend any time outside today? What weather-related questions do you have about the cold? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's do this. Let's go to the phones first. Let's go to Ellen in Cedarburg. Good afternoon, Ellen. Welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to tell you that I thought it would be interesting just to feel what 40 degrees below zero felt like. So I bundled up and I went outside and I tried to find a coffee shop that was open and they were all closed, and I went back about as fast as you can get. So I've had my experience now.
But you're okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. Thank you so much, Ellen. It is really, really cold outside. And in fact, I heard from a friend who was talking about someone who had that same experience. He was from the West Coast and wanted to see, they were in town for a conference and wanted to see what it would feel like to walk outside in this type of weather because he had never felt it before. He walks outside the hotel and he says, well, everything seems to be fine, until he walked to the end of the block and then he turned. And then he felt the gust of wind, and he immediately ran back in the hotel. Let's go to Jonathan Erdman. He is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Darrell, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad. I'm hopefully, Jonathan, you're somewhere warm as well.
Yeah, I decided to do this interview inside this time. I stepped outside for about 30 seconds to do the infamous boiling water trick this morning, and I decided that was enough for one day.
You know, I noticed, Jonathan, that there are some news, some television news stations that are doing this the soda challenge. They're putting sodas outside in the cold and trying to see which brand of soda will burst first. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that. I'm going to look that up after this interview, but that sounds intriguing. I've heard that's done with some alcohol products, too, that I won't mention, but I'll have to check that out.
So today is supposed to be the coldest of this string of cold days, correct?
Well, I'd really love to say that that's true, but unfortunately, tomorrow morning could be even a few degrees colder in some spots. So just to shed some perspective on this, Madison's Dane County Regional Airport dropped to 26 below zero this morning. That was their coldest temperature in almost 23 years, since February 3rd of 1996. Milwaukee dropped to 20 below zero this morning. That was their coldest since that same outbreak. And Eau Claire hit 30 below zero, also the coldest since that February 96 outbreak. But unfortunately, tomorrow morning, it's possible that Madison could see only the third day with a low in the 30s below zero in records dating to the 1930s. And that last happened in 1963. So unfortunately, it could even be colder tomorrow morning.
Wow. Jonathan, can you let our listeners know just how dangerous it is out there?
Well, you know, if the typical rule of thumb is, you know, and let me just start first by saying that's the problem with this particular cold outbreak has been the wind. Now, oftentimes when we get extreme cold like this in the upper Midwest, you'll have extreme cold with clear skies and light winds, you know, a fresh snow cover on the ground. It'll just be still as can be. And then you wake up in the morning and it's 20, 30 below zero. But what's so insidious about this cold outbreak is the wind, and the wind just isn't letting up. So, yeah, when you get wind chills like we've seen already in the 50s below zero, you can get frostbite on exposed skin in as little as 5 minutes. So this isn't the case where you can just take the dog for a walk around the neighborhood and then come back and have no impact. If you're not covering exposed skin, you can get frostbite that quickly, and that's how dangerous this is.
These temperatures are the result of something called the polar vortex. What does the polar vortex mean?
Well, you know, it's funny. That term first kind of became a pop culture phenomenon about 5 years ago in January of 2014. Meteorologists have known about the polar vortex basically since before the Civil War. The polar vortex has been there in the atmosphere as long as there's been weather. And basically what it is, it's this big gyre of low pressure that sits near the poles in the winter months. And probably the easiest way to think about it is when the polar vortex is strong, so, you know, it's this circular vortex way up in the atmosphere, well above jet stream level. When it's strong, it keeps cold air masses at bay over the Arctic regions. But when the polar vortex weakens a bit, when it becomes, and sometimes it even fragments into two, then all of a sudden it's like the floodgates are open to cold air, and the cold air can flood into Europe, and it floods into the central and eastern United States. And we saw that polar vortex weakening right around New Year's Day, and typically there's a few weeks lag from when that happens to when the cold air arrives in the U.S., and it can be pretty nasty, as we've seen.
Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. He joins us today. We're talking about the record-breaking cold weather, and we're asking you to give us a call to give us your perspective on the cold. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Tyler. He is calling from North Carolina, and he's here on business. Tyler, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here. So I would say that don't come to the Midwest underestimating the power of the weather. It's literally, you step outside and breathing through my nose hairs freeze to the side of my nose. It's painful to breathe, and I really underestimated it coming here, but I don't know if you guys have mentioned this before, but these temperatures are competing with Mount Everest temperatures, so it is beyond cold and pretty tough for a southerner like me to handle. So just a heads up to anyone else coming from the south to visit.
Tyler, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to John in Suring, Wisconsin. John, welcome to Central Time.
Good day. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, I just have a comment. You know, I used to, where I'm living at, I used to go to school up here back when I was a lot younger, in 69, 70. And we'd go to school, be 20 below, and be blowing like heck, and go to school and do our thing, come back home. And then we jump on our snowmobile and run 56 miles an hour. Didn't seem to bother us. What's the big deal?
John, thank you so much for the call. And Jonathan, I've heard that from quite a few others who have said that, you know, this weather isn't anything unlike what they've experienced when they were younger. And, you know, they did a number of activities outside. Can you explain to folks what the difference is between what had been like when they were younger to what's happening now?
Well, I completely understand what John was saying. You know, I'm a child of the epic winters of the late 1970s, which, you know, for any listeners that grew up during those times, those were benchmark winters. And for those that are a little bit older, you know, some winters in the 50s and 60s really measured up as well. I think it's a case where, you know, these days we can, you know, we still get these cold air outbreaks, but they may, and they may persist for a few days, but they may be a little bit less intense than, or long lasting than perhaps what we saw in the, say, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, even in the 1980s. So it's, you know, I think school districts, and I can't speak for school districts, but I think they're just more cautious now. Obviously, if kids are getting frostbite and in 50, 60 below wind chills, that could be a PR problem, maybe a, you know, legal problem for some school districts. So I think they just want to play it really safe, in these days.
Jonathan, a winter storm expert in Boston, said the unusual cold could stick around for another 8 weeks or through mid-March, just in time for the first official day of spring. We've got just about a minute or so left. What does the long-range forecast look like to you?
Well, I'll start with a little bit of good news. We're going to see a massive warm-up this weekend, coincident with Groundhog Day. So believe it or not, much of the state of Wisconsin will warm above freezing by Saturday. Imagine that. So
wow.
60 to 70 degree temperature change. Unfortunately, that may not last very long. It's looking like about around the middle of next week, maybe Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, the cold is going to come back. Maybe not the ferocity that we've seen this week. But unfortunately, with the rest of February does look quite cold through most of the northern plains and upper Midwest. Hopefully, our long-range forecasters are suggesting that March may actually be a little bit warmer, maybe be warmer than average. Hopefully, we won't have a repeat of what we saw last April. I don't know if you remember last April, but last April was the coldest April on record in Wisconsin dating to 1895. Hopefully, we'll see nothing like that. But unfortunately, the rest of February does look, in general, cold after this Groundhog Weekend.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. You stay warm.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. We talked with him about what's causing all the cold weather this week, and earlier we spoke with WPR reporters Corey Hess and Hope Kerwin. Coming up after the news, we'll check in on all of the latest news in national politics. Stay with us. I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. As the coldest weather in decades blankets the state, we want to help you stay safe. Check WPR.org/weather for timely information on current conditions and what to expect in the days to come. That's WPR.org/weather. Wanted to mention that Madison Schools has announced that they will be closed again tomorrow. That goes along with Milwaukee and many schools in those surrounding areas. Coming up, Foxconn is no longer planning to manufacture LCD television screens at its facility in southeastern Wisconsin. We'll find out what that means for employment and the tax incentives the company negotiated with the state. First, it's our time for our weekly check-in on the latest political news from Washington, D.C. While the government shutdown has been temporarily suspended and federal employees are back to work, lawmakers have a February 15th deadline to find money for border security, or else we could see the government shut down once again. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi extended an invitation to President Trump this week to deliver the State of the Union after canceling the address, citing security concerns during the shutdown. And we're also seeing a growing field of Democratic and independent candidates throw their hat into the ring for the 2020 presidential race. And our question for you this week is, which candidates are you watching and who do you hope runs? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll tackle that question in just a bit. But first, our guest this week is Ginger Gibson. She's a political correspondent at Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Darrell. Nice to be on with you.
Nice to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes. Today was the first day that lawmakers began negotiating funding for border security, which, as a reminder, was the primary reason the government was shut down for the last month. Are lawmakers feeling the pressure to reach an agreement to head off another shutdown?
The clock is ticking for lawmakers. But like legislative processes, it can only move so fast. The first meeting was held today. This is a bicameral, bipartisan meeting, so members of the House, the Senate, Republicans, and Democrats. And they did what politicians do best. They read speeches. Everyone was giving their opening remarks today, what they hope to see accomplished. But it's not really any of the nitty-gritty of deal-making. We did get some preview of where everyone stands, and a suggestion that Nita Lowey, the top Democrat in the House portion, is putting together a preliminary offer, something from which they could start negotiating.
I'll start with Republicans first. What's going to be on the table for them as they negotiate?
This one's tough because we have to look at this as essentially two different ideologies all on the Republican side. First off, there are the Trump-aligned portions, and we saw that it took several lawmakers speaking until we got to one that mentioned a wall, who then said, actually, it could be some type of structure. But the president has insisted he wanted a wall. He seems to be backing down off of that. But the Republican Party at large, the rest of his party, has been quite open to more comprehensive adjustments and changes to the immigration law, some of them which might not be entirely consistent with the president's ideology. So the Republicans almost have two factions in this process, ones that are going to be pushing for a much more hardline approach to immigration and others that might be open to things like DACA, pathways to citizenship to those already in the country illegally, and other provisions that have been in previous comprehensive immigration reforms.
Well, you talked about the Republicans and how they're split into two different camps. What are Democrats hoping to get out of this negotiation process?
Democrats, first and foremost, don't want to see the government closed again after the deadline on the 15th. But they're not willing to give up money for a wall. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made clear as they were in the process of reopening the government that they aren't going to fund a wall. They would, however, fund a good deal of other border security. And here's the thing that's really fascinating about this. You could see a very high-tech, high-scale, near militarization of the border. Things that Democrats are saying, like drones and sensors, that they might not have supported in another situation. But to reach some kind of compromise and to not allow a wall to be built, they are starting to, and not just starting, they have flatly said they would support some of those additions.
Now, lawmakers really only have 3 weeks to put together a plan that the president will sign off on. Is there a sense of urgency on Capitol Hill?
There is a sense of urgency. There is a desire to at least figure out if they can come to a deal and figure out if that's going to be the path to reaching a funding agreement in the next 3 weeks or if they're going to have to start over from scratch to try to avoid another government shutdown.
Speaking from the Rose Garden last Friday, President Trump had this to say.
If we don't get a fair deal from Congress, the government will either shut down on February 15th again, or I will use the powers afforded to me under the laws and the Constitution of the United States to address this emergency.
Now, the president is indicating that he could declare a state of emergency. Do we have a sense or an indication of how serious he is about doing this?
I think we can assume that the president is very serious about this, and that is why he continues to point to it as an option. But we should also understand that members of his own party are very opposed to taking this step. It would be an unprecedented use of power, and it would fly in the face of many of their criticism of the previous president, and they realize that. They're also worried that it would set a new precedent that could allow future Democratic presidents and Congresses to do things that they wouldn't want done under the auspice that it was an emergency. And for that reason, I think behind closed doors, the president is receiving a lot of pushback, even from his own allies in Congress, that he doesn't move forward with that decision.
So what will you be watching for over the next few weeks as negotiations continue?
The big things to to watch for is if they start to settle on pieces. A lot of times when members of Congress sit down to negotiate big policy positions, they work incrementally. They'll come to an agreement that they think they can get 70% or 60% of their membership on board with one provision, and then they'll move on to the next. If you don't start to see those incremental accomplishments, headlines that say they agree on pieces of a deal, that won't be a good sign that they'll be able to reach any deal in the next 3 weeks.
Ginger Gibson is our guest. She's a political correspondent at Reuters, and we're talking about the news of the week, the political news of the week in Washington, D.C. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi extended an invitation to President Trump to deliver the State of the Union address from the House. She originally rescinded the invitation during the shutdown, citing security concerns. Now, the shutdown is over for now. Is the shift a surprise from Pelosi, or was this expected?
This was expected. We saw the first withdrawal of the invitation really as Nancy Pelosi not wanting the president to come into her chamber and criticize her members for not giving him a wall on her invitation. Now that the government is open, tradition would dictate that she's not got much grounds. It is true that this will come right in the middle of this period in which the government could turn around and be shut again in a few weeks, but hard to justify not reaching a date as something that is so traditional as a State of the Union address.
Yeah, there was some speculation that opposing parties could disinvite a president from delivering the State of the Union address in the future as a political move, which some said Pelosi was doing when she first rescinded the invitation. Do you think Pelosi was able to do some potential damage control with this?
Pelosi was trying to show that she was willing to hear from the president, just not willing to do so on those exact terms. There was, of course, criticism from both sides, but I think a little bit of what we see, especially in a situation like a government shutdown, is if you're inclined to be critical of Nancy Pelosi, you're going to think the move was terrible. If you're inclined to think that she's great and a wonderful leader, you're going to think that the move was reasonable. A lot of this is confirmation bias. You know, people are going to just assume one way or another based on what they already think about these people.
And as much as you can guess, what do you think the president will focus the most on when he delivers the State of the Union on February 5th?
You know, State of the Union addresses have traditionally been an opportunity for a president to lay out their policy agenda, to really get in the weeds about policies they would like to see enacted in the next year. President Trump has two sort of challenges in front of him. The first off, his party doesn't control one chamber anymore. So things that he might have said had they continued to control the House probably won't hear as much about that as we would have otherwise. Additionally, the president is just not a wonky policy guy. This really isn't his forte. And so giving a long policy address is often not something the president feels inclined to do. And for that reason, we might hear a little less policy. Really, the president is about messaging, is about broad messaging. And it will not be lost on him that it's 3 weeks until the government could shut down again. So expect to hear a real full-throated defense of his positions on the wall and what he wants to see Congress do between now and that 15th deadline.
We're talking to Ginger Gibson right now. She's a political correspondent at Reuters and is with us to talk about all things political going on in Washington, D.C. Coming up after the break, the field of candidates in the 2020 presidential election is growing. So our question for you this week is, which candidates are you watching and who do you hope runs? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll tackle that question next. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner. Right now, we continue our conversation about national politics with Ginger Gibson. She's a political correspondent at Reuters. Among the biggest political news over the last week is that there is a presidential election on the horizon, and Democrats and independent hopefuls have already started announcing they'll run for the White House. So our question for you today is, what candidates are already making an impression on you? And who would you like to see run in 2020? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's go to the 2020 candidate field. It may be only January, but a number of presidential hopefuls have either announced that they're planning on running for president or they have established exploratory committees. Before we get to the potential candidates themselves, is it normal, Ginger, to see this much interest at this point in the election cycle?
Seeing a lot of interest early, that is unusual. Part of this is the fact that we have Democrats running this time and not Republicans. If you may recall, 4 years ago when a lot of Republicans were running, there were Democrats, but just far fewer of them. They held off on announcing their campaigns so that they could fundraise for their super PACs. This was a trend started by Jeb Bush. Democrats are eschewing super PACs and corporate donations, so they aren't going to take the time to do that fundraising. And because they're eschewing that corporate money, they have to spend more time raising it. I think that's why we see so many of them getting in so early, so that they can try to round up that cash that they're going to need a year from now when they start running really expensive television ads.
Now, so far for the Democrats, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, former Maryland Representative John Delaney, Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, and California Senator Kamala Harris have all announced that they're running. Those are some pretty well-known politicians. Why do you think the candidates are eager to get their names out there now as opposed to a little later?
If you look at the polling, you'll see that name recognition, especially at this point, is one of the most critical elements of a candidacy. Vice President Joe Biden, who has not made a decision about running, leads the pack overwhelmingly in polls, and really that's because people know his name. And so these candidates need to get their names out there so that they can start to register in these polls. And registering the polls is going to be really important. That's the proof that they take to donors to try to get them to give money. And it's also going to be potentially part of the way in which they get included in debates that begin this summer between the candidates.
Now, you spoke about former Vice President Joe Biden, that there's a possibility that he'll challenge President Trump. And he hasn't said anything official, but some polling indicates that he would have support, as you mentioned, from a number of voters. What would a Biden campaign look like against a Trump reelection bid?
I mean, to be clear, Biden leads in all of these primary polls because he's well known. If he got in the race, he would still have to run what would be a very difficult race and beat some very serious challengers, and he's no guarantee to get the nomination. But I think if we saw a matchup between Vice President Joe Biden and President Trump, there would be some interesting exchanging of verbal spats between the two of them. They are both not ones to mince their words. And I think we would see Biden making the case that he could return the White House to normalcy, that he already knows how the institution works, that he wouldn't have to learn on the job, and that he could correct some of the chaos that has been created by President Trump.
Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz made some waves by announcing that he's planning on running as an independent. And we heard already that there was a concern, at least from a few folks, who, including one person who raised their concern very loudly about Schultz running. How concerned are people that Schultz could split the field of candidates?
There is clearly a lot of concern in Democratic quarters that a well-funded, i.e. a rich person running as an independent, would create a lot of problems for Democrats. They're worried that Trump's base is just so loyal that they are only going to vote for him, but that the rest of the voters could be divided. Voters that might have otherwise gone to a Democrat, but instead would go to Schultz. I mean, I think it's clear, and Schultz has said so himself, that looking at the Democratic primary, he just didn't see a route to victory there. He didn't think he could win. I will be surprised if he finds much of a route to victory as an independent. That is a big hill to climb. It is a very daunting task, given the way our system is structured. And so it may be that he doesn't run, but if he does, he's going to have to contend with a lot of Democratic criticism about that decision.
Could we see any serious Republican challengers to President Trump?
That remains to be seen. We saw the announcement yesterday from Arizona Senator Jeff Flake that he would not challenge the president. He had made comments before to reporters that he would challenge the president if another Republican didn't emerge. There was speculation that either he had abandoned that or maybe knew something the rest of us didn't. To be clear, the polls show that the president has a solid base of support within his party. His administration, his political people, his campaign have made sure that the RNC, the Republican National Party, is all in line with him. So there isn't a lot of holes there to try to punch through a good base of support.
Now, there's a lot to look at as the 2020 election shapes up. We'll continue this conversation tomorrow and take your calls. Until then, you can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. Now I want to shift the focus to some U.S. foreign relations news. White House National Security Advisor John Bolton raised some eyebrows last week when his notes were fully displayed on camera saying 5,000 troops to Colombia. Now, this came on the heels of some political trouble brewing in neighboring Venezuela, leading to speculation that the United States military might get involved in Central America. What have some people been saying in Washington, D.C. about this?
That moment with the notebook has our notepad has raised more questions than it has provided answers. There's still a lot of open questions about what exactly he meant, whether or not this is a strategy we just got a peek into, whether or not this was underway already or an idea someone had floated, why he would have walked into a nationally televised briefing with that on his notebook, regardless of the reason. But we haven't gotten answers to those things. What we have gotten is a little bit of pushback from Democrats in Congress, including some that were tweeting their responses by having pictures of them carrying notepads. We saw one House member who said that the president doesn't have the authority to do that, another who reminded the president he would need to go to Congress to get permission, reference to checks and balances. But really, that moment with the notepad was more confusing than it was illuminating at this point.
Well, obviously, this is still developing, but what will you be watching for over the next few weeks?
On this front, I would be watching for how the U.S. is handling the situation in Venezuela in general, whether or not we see additional remarks after the initial recognition of the new government, and what conversations are taking place between top-level administration officials like Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the members of Congress. They would need Congress's help to do something like that. And so we know in the past when administrations are trying to get Congress on board, we'll start seeing more briefings, we'll start seeing more discussions, they'll start trying to up their level of understanding about the issue in anticipation of possibly needing them to vote.
Now, I want to switch really quickly to the Mueller investigation. We just have about a minute left, but speculation has been rampant since it began, but Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker announced that the probe is coming to a close. What has been the reaction to the news in Washington?
We are all waiting on pins and needles to see if we're going to get a report out of Mueller. He filed charges against Roger Stone, which means at least the prosecutorial process isn't close to coming to a close. But I think there'll be a lot of people here who are just waiting to read that report whenever they get it.
What are you on the lookout for?
Would be on the lookout for dismantling of his team or some type of movement to file papers. Also remember that we're going to get a new AG here pretty soon, AG Barr. Any changes or announcements he might make would be illuminating as well.
Ginger, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Stay warm. We're all sending warm thoughts your way.
Thank you so much. You take care. Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent at Reuters. She joined us to talk about the latest political news happening at the nation's capital. Tune in tomorrow at 4:30 to hear more about the Democratic and independent candidates for the 2020 presidential race. We will be talking about that tomorrow at 4:30 right here on Central Time. You can also You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can email us. You can log on to our Facebook page. Tell us who you're excited about possibly running for president. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard about the Fyre Festival, the disaster that was the Fyre Festival, and the fact that Netflix and Hulu have run documentaries. We had the interview with the Netflix folks last week about the Fyre Festival and what happened there. But there's actually a Fyre Festival LARP. It's being planned to take place at Belle Isle, right outside of Detroit. JC Larson is with me. She's a producer for Central Time. She used to live in the area. JC, what can you tell us about this?
So I first saw this reported in the Detroit Metro Times, and it pretty much got the reaction that a lot of people assumed it would get. A lot of people thought it was very funny. A lot of people said, hey, I will go to that. There has been a little bit of a change in the plans. I just looked at their Facebook page, and basically the Michigan DNR, so the Department of Natural Resources, said, you cannot hold this event on Belle Isle, which is a beautiful park, but I imagine it would have a number of logistical issues because there's really only one way to get on and off that island. So it's been moved to the enclave of Hamtramck, which I imagine is also going to provide some headaches for the people who live there because it is extremely small and extremely dense. So who knows, maybe in that area we will see a lot of millennials going crazy for a little while, but I guess we'll have to see.
Wow, I just can't imagine why anybody would want to live-action role-play a disaster.
Yeah,
at the Fyre
it feels
Festival.
Like a big mess.
There's more to come right here on Central Time. Stay with us.